Group meeting, Friday, 16th October, 1981. Last month, we considered in depth the meaning of the word samadhi. And we saw that the English word meditation is not really the equivalent of the word samadhi. The profoundest meditative state is samadhi. We may equate it with the unio mystica of a European tradition, of a Christian tradition, and so forth, you see. Now, this state comes into being, this is what we dealt with last time, this state comes into being when the psyche, utterly purified, can be still and silent. And then it offers no obstruction to the free functioning of this universal energy, which we may call pure mind, chitta in the Hindu-Buddhist tradition. Pure mind, functioning freely through one's purified psyche. Otherwise it doesn't. All the world talks in terms of my mind, his mind, your mind, and so forth. None of us has mind. We might just as well say my space, your space, or anybody else's space. But just as space is a universal thing and a mysterious universal something, you see, so too mind is universal. It is that archetypal form of the primordial creative energy which releases cosmos out of chaos. You see? And that is mind. But that mind, coming in touch with the physical body, structured as it is, the human body, gives rise to our psyche. And the psyche is rooted in our brain and nervous system, the ductus, the activity of the ductus glands, and so on. So that we can legitimately talk of my psyche. And by psyche, of course, I mean, in the usual way, all our ordinary mental, emotional processes, our states of mind, as we call them, our thoughts, our feelings, and so on. That is all the realm of the psyche. Now, the psyche is considerably influenced by the body. Very considerably, that is to say our mental states as we call them, especially the activity of the ductus glands, and of course the brain structure which makes it possible for a person to produce in the world what he is able to produce and so forth. Mind, pure and simple, is quite independent of bodily influence. Because mind itself is a transcendent energy, whereas the psychophysical organism is a perishable thing. It lasts only as long as we live, and then that's the end of both psyche and body. Now this functioning, this free functioning of mind is not knowable by us in the ordinary way, that is to say, in the terms of thought and speech, which is which are brain activities. You will find this also brought out in the Majjhima Nikaya, the first volume, in the Mahavedala Sutta. You see, where speech is regarded as just part of the perishable process as such. Now, today, I think we ought to, first of all, start by emphasizing the importance of silence. And by silence here is meant not merely holding one's tongue, but, if I may coin a phrase, holding one's brain. Our thinking process, our discursive thought, our turmoil of feelings and reactions and so on and so on, all that has to become silent. And when the whole psychophysical organism is quite peaceful, poised and silent, then this transcendent energy mind functions without any hindrance offered by the organism. It's if you like, we can conveniently use a word like the divine functioning through the divine, which is eternal, immortal, infinite, functions through the finite, the temporal and the mortal, our own self, as we call it, you see. Now, the importance of silence, it comes out in all the scriptures of the world, in the Gathas of Zarathustra, for instance. There is the statement in one of the yasnas, the writings are called the yasnas, just as with Buddhism it's the suttas and so on, you see. In yasna 43 verse 15, silent meditation is the best for attaining spiritual enlightenment. Now note the significance of that. Silent meditation is the best for attaining spiritual enlightenment. What is our ordinary meditation like? It's a long verbal ritual. Our thinking process and feeling process, our feeling process also is a verbal ritual because we recognize our feeling and we name it, don't we? And we are able to follow its process and we can describe it. So whatever is descriptive in terms of speech is something which does not belong to the realm of the transcendent, the state of spiritual enlightenment. So, silent meditation is the best for attaining spiritual enlightenment. And Zarathustra, naturally, having realized these things himself, wrote that. Then again, in the Psalms, Psalm 46, verse 10, we have, "Be still and know that I am God." Be still. And it doesn't mean mere physical stillness. It means fundamentally, mainly, the complete stillness of this chattering of the brain. In the Upanishads, particularly Upanishads like the Mandukya, the Tejobindu, the Varaha, you find silence emphasized above all else. And this silence is linked up with, of course, the whole process of meditation, as we call it here in the ordinary way. In the Buddhist teaching, the Buddha says to his monks, when they are confabulating very vigorously about worldly matters and minor things, he says, "Monks, when you are gathered together, you should not talk about such things at all." And he says, "Dhammi va katha ariyo va tumhi bhava," which means either talk about the Dhamma or maintain the Aryan silence. And the Aryan silence is defined by Moggallana and Sariputta and the Buddha himself, and throughout the Nikayas you'll find this, as the entry into the second jhana. You know, you are conversant, aren't you, with the idea of the teaching of the jhanas and so on. In the first jhana, you have vitakka vichara, which is the ordinary discursive process. The discursive process, you see. And when that thought process calms down and then finally remains absolutely still and silent, then you are maintaining the Aryan silence. And that Aryan silence is the condition in which the psychic sensitivities expand, and from then on to the limit to which they can expand. You can become very sensitive. So you have to rather beware also of these things. You'll find the same things taught in Christian mysticism, in what they call the origin of quiet. And in its spoilt form, it becomes what was known as quietism, which implied that, oh, you thought you had finished and all you had to do was to be vacant and vacuous, you see. Now, in Christian mysticism, the origin of quiet culminates in the rapture and ecstasy of the contemplative's unio mystica, when that supreme union with the ultimate is realized. Of course, in Christian terms, the union with God, as they call it, you see. Now, this is the supreme meditative state. Now, what is the significance of the pure state of the psyche? If the psyche isn't purified, you needn't waste your time attempting to meditate. First of all, consider why one wants to meditate. What is it that moves us towards it? You know, there are these transcendental meditation and dozens of other movements like that, all of which hold out some carrot or other to the donkey. You will experience wonderful visions and auditions and this, that and the other. You will become quiet and calm and solve all your problems of anxiety and whatnot and whatnot. You will be successful in life. It's all centered upon the self and something to be gained for the self. Now, this is the very antithesis of the religious life and religious living and the purpose of meditation. To use the word which is commonly used today, although it is not a very good word. It's an inadequate word, but still we'll have to use it. So, what is the significance then of the pure state of the psyche, where all these self-pursuits are completely out? Well, as the Buddha used to say, all the defilements of the mind are no longer present. That is one aspect, one meaning of the pure psyche. Then comes, here, I think I must interrupt that, we'll deal with it, that all the defilements are out. The question arises, is the body chemistry then, the activity of the glands and so forth, transformed? Because if your adrenals are powerful and so forth, you will have plenty of anger and so forth coming out in reaction against various things that happen around you, won't they? And so on and so on. Now, actually, when the psyche is purified, all these do undergo a transformation. In fact, the actual cells of the brain undergo transformation. This is not sufficiently known and certainly not much acknowledged by science yet. But investigations are gradually leading to this idea that there is a transformation of the brain cells themselves, you see, and they don't function in any way which is evil. Well, that was the first point. All the defilements are out. Second, there is no reaction in the person whose psyche is pure of lust and greed, of anger, envy, malevolence, hate, and fear. There is no such reaction from him, whatever the circumstance may be, however provocative it may be. There is freedom from illusions and delusions. We think that we know this, that, or the other, and so forth. And if we look carefully into our own mental processes, we will see that we are conditioned and we are imprisoned by our biases, our prejudices, our preconceptions, our assumptions, and of course all our uncontrolled, uninhibited, immediate emotional reactions, you see. Now, there is, therefore, with the psyche in that state and the brain alone being active, not pure mind, but the brain alone, which is the concretest expression of mind, being active, and under the influence of all those forces which operate in us because of our animal descent, aggressiveness, fear, and so on, domination, and all the rest of it, you see. We think that we know this, that, or the other. We have certain ideas, convictions, beliefs, scores of beliefs, and they are all utterly useless where truth is concerned. They are all utterly useless. And as one gradually calms down inside and grows, one sees that this is not the real thing. It may be partly, that is to say, it may be on the way, but it is not the real truth. So there is freedom from that when the psyche is purified. And therefore, in everyday life, there is no stupid action. One of the points the Buddha makes with regard to the arahat, that he never acts as a result of stupidity. See? Or as the result of partiality. This ties up with the whole idea of beliefs and convictions. We are therefore partial because of our beliefs and convictions, and we differ from the other person and so forth to the extent of being in conflict with him. We can't understand him and so on. Also, there is no vested interest whatsoever. All vested interest springs up in us only in terms of worldliness. If we have a vested interest in spiritual development, in serving God and being, you know, the right hand of the Father and all that sort of stuff, it simply means that we don't know what we are talking about. You can't have a vested interest in your own development, your own fulfillment and the spiritual life and so on. This universal process, the developmental process, inevitably, inexorably brings to fruition that which is inherently contained within the particular species or organism. It happens by itself, we as human beings, because we have the power of choice, because we have some sort of intelligence, we can choose to understand the process as far as the human race is concerned and willingly and happily cooperate with it without demanding anything for oneself. That is a sine qua non, so long as there is a demand for the self. And the demand for the self is extraordinarily subtle. It is one of the most difficult things to ferret out and be free of. As long as there is a demand for the self, then you have put paid to the spiritual life, to the religious life, to your own real fulfillment and fruition, to your own real happiness and freedom and well-being. The state of the world today, and one doesn't need to say anything about it, everybody sees it and knows what it is like, is due to this sort of imprisonment of the person within his flaws, you see. Well now, that sort of purity of the psyche is the soil in which meditation flowers. So now obviously we are as we are, since we are not exactly in this state of the utterly pure psyche. For us, our starting point is constant mindfulness. And the mindfulness has to be constant and pure. Constant, you can't imagine how constant it has to be. It is continuous, it has to be continuous throughout one's life. The Buddha himself talks about it with regard to himself, that he's always mindful, he's never unmindful any moment of the day or any hour of the day. In his sleep too, he is mindful. You find the same idea, same teaching brought out in the Upanishads, not the usual great Upanishads as they are called, but in the so-called Yoga Upanishads. This mindfulness even in your sleep. And then the process which goes on in the ordinary way as our dream state is no longer a dream state which you can't control. It just is a working out of what was not worked out during your waking state, you see, and your anxieties and all the rest of it has its influence, have their influence upon your dream state. But in your dream state, it becomes like a directed meditative process. Instead of just dreaming wildly like that, there is a directive process, and it is probably that which produces some of the illuminating ideas when you wake up. You suddenly say, "Ah, I've got it. The answer has come," so to say. You see. That is because even in the dream state, you are mindful. You know what you're doing. Now, the mindfulness has to be pure. One mustn't practice mindfulness in order to get some personal benefits or develop psychic powers or obtain praise. All those things have to be out. And when one is mindful, one must be utterly free of all judgments. Observe the fact and see, this is good, this is right, this is bad, this is evil. You see, observe the fact, but don't condemn what is evil. People say, "Oh, I hate the sin and not the sinner." Well, that is a little bit of an absurd statement. If there were no sinner, there'd be no sin. So when I say that I hate the sin and not the sinner, I'm only subtly fooling myself that I'm not hating the sinner. Because there is no question of hating anything at all if there is no sin, and there is no sin if there is no sinner. You see, now mindfulness awakens us to all these tricks that the psyche plays. Our mindfulness must be unsullied by our standards, judgments, evaluations, criteria, our beliefs and convictions, etc. It has to be pure observation. And in this pure observation, not only does one observe the object which one is observing, but one also is fully awake to the reactions from the brain to that which one is observing. You see somebody kicking a dog or doing something like that, you see, and see what your brain does immediately, the language it uses and the impulse it gives you to kick the fellow for kicking a dog and so on, you see. It's a marvelous training, and this mindfulness never ceases. Its ultimate its final culmination is the pure meditative state, the ultimate meditative state, the state of true samadhi. Now, this kind of mindfulness develops the sensitivity to subtler influences. I've already mentioned that. Beware of the psychical type of influences. You'll become more and more sensitive to the psychical atmosphere and so forth. So, beware of reactions arising. If a hate reaction arises, well, you can't heal. You can't really put right if you hate. Because the act of the atmosphere of hate and the act of hate cuts off the other person. One has to be capable of being completely poised, see that this is a terrible wrong being done, and yet sit down and discuss together at the round table for the good of the sinner as well as the one who is sinned against. This is the point. You know, Plato brings that out very well in the Republic, where he says that justice is a taxis kai cosmos, an ordered state which is for the benefit of the whole, the wrongdoer and the wrong done. This is a marvelous, marvelous teaching. So now, you have to beware of these subtle influences, because some of the psychical influences which you will contact can be demonic as well as angelic. Some will be angelic, but some will be demonic also. So you have to distinguish between the two and beware not to react. Then there'll be influences of the mental type, the purely intellectual type. But here the difficulty is you must be careful not to put aside bees in one of your bonnet. They become bees in one's bonnet. The Buddha talks of it in the Brahmajala Sutta, that a person, whilst he's meditating or considering something deeply, he suddenly gets an idea. It's only a bee in his bonnet, as the Buddha says. He knows about all this and the peril thereof. He talks about the peril thereof. Because you get a half-truth, when you get a half-truth, and you try to, and you treat it as the whole truth and try to live by it, then woe unto yourself and to your surroundings. So you have to be aware of that. But these mental, the mental type sensitivities, can also be deep insights. But when they are deep insights, you will really know, because they will always be accompanied by a sense of unity with everything and everyone around you, and a perfect inward poise, no disturbance inside, you see. And if it is of the truly spiritual type of sensitivity, right in the spiritual depths, then you will find that the greatest effect is, it is the most powerful influence to unself us, to free us from our selfness and our clinging to the separate self, the separate self. That's the whole thing. Then it is a truly spiritual influence. You have to be very honest. One has to be very honest with oneself and really sensible, utterly sensible about it. People get conceits that, oh, now they are at this stage, or I've heard people here in this room when they have come to see me and talk or discuss some of these things, and at the summer school too, talk about being in the second or the third jhana. They don't know what they are talking about. Absolute illusions, complete illusions. So beware of that. But this mindfulness, this samasati, is the linchpin of the religious life and of meditation and everything connected with it. Now, the mindfulness reveals to us just what we are and just what the world is. And it also shows us our relationship to the world. And it also indicates how we should live and act in the world, in any and every situation. And by act, I don't mean just the physical part of action. You know how the Buddha says that a thought is a mental deed. A word is a deed of speech. And a physical action is a deed of the body. They're all deeds, if you like, you see. And the next thing that we can find out, we will find out, is this, that we'll see what we are, we'll see what the world is, and we will discover that each one of us will see that that I am the world and the world is me. It's no good saying, oh, I am like this, but the world is like that, holier than thou. You see, all that will be completely out. And it's very difficult. It's extremely difficult, because it's so easy to be critical. Now, if we do see this, really see it, that is to say, not just see it as merely as a mental observation and hold the logical thought that this is this and this is that, that is that, you see, and so forth, but become fully conscious of it. When you become fully conscious, then you know in a manner which is independent of the limitations of the brain activity. We know things via our brain. All that we know is brain knowledge. Now, that brain knowledge, of course, is also indispensable in life, in everyday life, and it has its own proper sphere, true enough. Its proper sphere is, if you like to use one word, technical. What to do here, what to do there, because you know that this is so and that is so, and therefore one has to do this and do that in everyday life. But when you are fully conscious of something, that something becomes totally transformed. Your knowledge of it is of a nature which is indescribable. Because when you are fully conscious, you are that of which you are conscious, in mind and consciousness only, not bodily, obviously. Now, you see how mindfulness plays its part. We have to look, we have to listen, we have to touch, we have to smell, we have to think, and so forth, you see. All these things have to be done. You look at a tree. In the ordinary way, you look at it, oh yes, there's an old oak tree there, you see. So there's a nice rose bush here. Perfunctory. There is no oneness between myself, the onlooker, and that which I am looking at. There is no unity. There is a separateness. I, the self, am separate from that, the object. Now, that sort of seeing is very perfunctory, and it is not the real seeing. When you pay complete attention to what you are looking at, what you are listening to, and so forth, then you become fully conscious of it, and you are at one with it inwardly. You know it inside out, so to say. Not necessarily in the manner of the scientist who can write a tome upon the petals of this particular kind of rose, you see. It's not that kind of knowledge, but a totally different kind of knowing. So now, if we do see so completely, we would cease criticizing or appraising others. And thus we can enable a right relationship between the so-called other and oneself to grow. When you are fully conscious, there is no other. There is only unity. That which is looked at, that which is heard, tasted, smelled, felt, you see, that and oneself are completely at one. One has to experience this. One can't explain it analytically too much, because the very act of analytical explanation separates, divides. Analysis means dividing, you see. And synthesis means a mechanical putting together. You don't synthesize your impressions. Your impressions get integrated into your whole being, your whole psychophysical being. And if the psychophysical being has been properly prepared, then mind in its fullness operates. And the whole of life is utterly transformed in your experience of it. So you get the right relationship between the psychophysical organism, which we commonly call and rightly call the self. The word self in English means just that. And purity and peace permeates the organism, which promotes the conversion of the ordinary discursive meditative process, the musing process, the talking process. It converts that into true meditation, the pure meditation. Now, being what we are, our attempts to meditate of necessity begin with discursive meditation. We can't get away from that. That is a fact which we have to acknowledge, that it does begin with a discursive process. It's something like this. When the little infant begins to grow up and he wants to learn the language, it learns its ABC. If you don't learn the ABC, you can't know the words, you can't have meanings to them afterwards, which come through your relationship with your experience. And so we have to begin with discursive meditation. Now, each of the religions commends its own set of meditation subjects. You know how the Visuddhimagga in the Buddhist scriptures talks about 40 subjects of meditation as such. And if you look at the spiritual spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola, that gives the Catholic, one of the Catholic methods of meditation. And I think Père Poulenc, I'm not quite sure of the name, he produced a work which gives the meditative subjects and so forth also. Now, concentrating attention upon the chosen theme develops the power of complete attentiveness irrespective of circumstance and time. We must remember that when we practice concentrating our attention upon some particular chosen theme or some particular observation which we may make through our senses, concentration tends to make one exclusive. You are excluding the rest of the world by concentrating upon the one thing. Supposing you concentrate your attention upon this microphone as such. Well, you can concentrate your attention so very powerfully, people do this and have done it, you see, that they are utterly oblivious of everything else but that, the microphone in front of them. See? But you see, the whole purpose of meditative process, the culminating in samadhi, in the pure samadhi or the unio mystica, is the unification of oneself with everything else. Everything else takes you into it as part and parcel of the one supreme whole, the one total reality. As such. But at first it is useful to practice concentration upon a chosen theme because it develops this power of complete attentiveness. Where complete attentiveness has been confined to one object, say the microphone, then as you grow in the later stages, you are able to be completely attentive to the entire situation in which you are. This again is an extraordinary experience, but it brings a considerable strain upon one. One has to bear that in mind. After all, the physical organism won't stand too much from... cannot withstand the impulses which come in to us, you see. Cannot withstand them. So one has to sort of have a kind of a protective shield. Physically, the brain does that trick because by a system of devices, filtering and selecting devices, the brain presents only a certain amount of matter to consciousness. It doesn't present... If for instance, every single impulse from our surrounding were to register itself as such and bring forth a response, we'd just perish. We couldn't survive it. So we have to bear these things in mind in connection with meditation. I've dealt with the sort of starting point. Then next month we'll deal perhaps with some of the obstructions which come up. Thank you.